good names that indicates that the person who have this name, they are good doers, they are good people.
Yes.
It tells us that you have to be careful about naming your children.
Yes.
So particularly, as you rightly mentioned, when you name your child as a Muslim with a name that it is strange and you do not understand its meaning, and it comes from the strangers, or let's say other kind of cultures and civilizations, have nothing to do with your culture.
Yeah,
with
sometimes
your religion,
we come very, very much a stylish sheikh, and luxurious in order to find a name that nobody has heard of, or the frequency of that name being repeated for the others is low. I mean, sometimes the parents are after low frequency names for the children so that their children's name will be unique and not repeated. I think this is not at all what Islam is after. Islam is after good names, or Islam is after, and by chance, we are not saying that the name necessarily, all those people who are called Muhammad will be good people.
Yeah,
no.
Of course not. Yeah.
Okay. It very much depends on your nurturing, on the system in which the person is grown up and is nurtured. No. But the case is that by one chance in 100, a person might be led again into the right path because of his name.
Of course.
Okay.
You know, Islamically, theologians in Islamic studies, they are of the view that man is equipped with free will by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then, of course, we cannot say that the names can influence on this free will, and there is a kind of determinism by this meaning that your name completely deterministically change, for example, your character, your characteristics. No, of course, it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritually talking, we can say that according to the Islamic teachings and doctrines, sometimes the names... For example, some of the names are really heavy, we can say, very kind of precious kind of names that some people may not tolerate this name.
Mm-hmm.
It is a kind of fact, spiritually talking. So that is why people say that some of the scholars are of the view that when you choose name, it should not be that much very strong and heavy kind of names.
Uh-huh.
And it should not be a kind of name that people make fun of him or mocking him, for example.
Yes.
And also, it should be a good name, giving a positive kind of sense to the people, to the children that you name them. That is why naming is really important, really significant.
Especially the people who convert to the religion of Islam, one of the first things they do is changing their names into an Islamic one. And Muhammad... Is the most selected one, even in the Britain's list. I mean, the English list of the popular names in Britain, Muhammad is among the top five one. Ali is also among the top five, we can say, names of the Islamic world. That's it. The boxer Muhammad Ali, when he's changed him to Muhammad, and Ali said Muhammad is the praiseworthy one, and Ali is the most high. Okay, that's why he selected his name. And we know that in the Walk of the Fame star, all the stars of the people are on the we can't say ground, but Muhammad Ali was on the wall. And when he was asked why do you so, he said because I don't want my name, that is Muhammad and Ali, be under the steps of the people of the ground. Mm. That much respect that he had for the names Muhammad and Ali on the Walk of Fame star in the Hollywood. That's right. Okay, Sheikh. The nicknames are also, are we allowed in Islam to select nicknames for our children? I mean, for example, he is Muhammad, but he is called so-and-so, or he is called Hassan and Hussein, but people call him this and that. Are we allowed?
Of course not, because Quran very explicitly tells us that wa la tanabadu bil alqab. It means that you should not call the people with those kind of names or nicknames. Sometimes people call someone with that name while the person who is given this title or name is not satisfied with that name. And of course,
you mean mocking the people and making jokes about them through their nickname. This is not
haram.
Welcome.
That's forbidden. Yeah, very explicitly. In the Holy Quran is mentioned. And of course, morally and ethically talking, again, it's really bad to make fun of people by some kind of bad titles or bad names giving to them and calling them with those kind
of
names.
Or making them popular among the people, you know, by such names. This is not at all welcomed in Islam. Some people select some names for the children which are not Islamic, but in order to Islamicize their names of the children, they add, we can say, holy names like Ali, Muhammad, and Hussein and Hassan, for example, or Fatima, to such names. I mean, they make a combination with two names. How much do you suggest such an action, Sheikh? For example, sorry, the person's name is, I don't know, the person's name is, for example, Arshia, for example. Look, is it Muhammad Arshia? Or, for example, Ali San, or something like that. How much?
You know, it depends. Sometimes, for example, you are living in a community, in a country, in a society. For example, where you need to have a kind of non-Islamic name as well.
Okay.
Because when you apply for a job, when you go to a school, university, there are kind of discriminations against, for example, a specific group of people. In some societies and communities, it rarely happens that, for example, when they call your name, or for example, sometimes you are living among, for example, you are a Shia, you're living in a society and community that most of the people are Nawasib. So, for example, here, if you name your child by two kind of names, and sometimes call him with that name that save, that protect him, that because of security, because of some problems, it is allowed. But in normal kind of situation, as you asked, I think in this kind of case, it's better not to do that. Yes, some names are, which we can say, neutral. Yeah, it does not have any positive sense or any negative sense. That's okay. But those names that are bad names or evil kind of names, we cannot combine them with the good names of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
But for a Muslim, normal situations, it's better not to do that,
Or sometimes there are some religious families who, we can say, are in a dilemma between selecting whether, for example, a national name for their children or an Islamic one. For example, their nationality are from Africa or, for example, France or Persia, Iran or something like that. So they don't know whether to choose the name of the, we can say, the Persian name or the Islamic name. They put the names in the Quran and they consult with the Quran to do so.
That's good. If good names are there, names, and you choose one of them, that would not be bad, of course, because all names are good. Makes no difference whether you put them inside the Quran or somewhere else, but it's a kind of tabarruk.
Yes.
That you try to bless it with the blessings of the Holy Quran. Good, yeah.
That's right.
It's no problem.
Okay, that's it. Okay. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return. Just to know you, whoever you are, laugh with you, learn from you, open to you my heart. But soon when I say goodbye and move on, I'm a traveler just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return. While I'm here, kind of neighbor who prays for you and me,
kind of neighbor who prays for you and me,
there for you, a shoulder to turn to. I'm a traveler just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return. Pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Been a pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Remember me, so I might be with you. I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return, waiting to return, return to my
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Almost 58,000 people have been killed by the Israeli regime in Gaza since the start of the genocide. Now, 187 civil society organizations and trade unions from across Europe have published a joint letter demanding that the EU suspends all official ties with Tel Aviv, a position backed by many EU legislators.
Iran replied to an Israeli illegal attack by bombing Israel. Okay, it's easy to condemn Iran, as you have done time and time again. But over the last years, Israel has bombed What is it? Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Sudan, Yemen. Of course, Palestine is illegally occupying Palestine, parts of Syria, illegally occupying parts of Lebanon. Are you able to condemn this?
Islamic Republic of Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is being accused of acting as a tool of the US and Israel in an effort to discredit Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. Simultaneously, many EU lawmakers say the West is complicit in Israel's campaign to starve Palestinians. People on the streets of Brussels seem to agree.
A lot of people are dying, a lot of kids. It's not a good situation.
I think the Israelis are scum of the earth.
It's a tragic crisis, no matter how you look at it or how you describe it.
I hope one day it will be better for them.
It's suggested that EU political leaders are enabling Israeli aggression because they fear upsetting the United States.
In fact, instead of holding Israel to account, President von der Leyen has Netanyahu, a war criminal, on speed dial, and she's actively encouraging to carry out illegal strikes on Iran.
Fresh calls have been made in the European Parliament for EU countries to close their airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu and enforce the arrest warrant issued against him by the International Criminal Court. Critics argue that the EU's credibility is in tatters due to its glaringly inconsistent foreign policy, imposing 18 rounds of tough sanctions against Russia, yet failing to take any meaningful action against the Israeli regime, despite an ever-growing catalogue of atrocities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A potential diplomatic thaw may be on the horizon between Iran and the United States. This, according to Iran's top foreign policy think tank, the Institute for Political and International Studies, IPIS. Experts examined the high stakes and uncertainties of renewed Iran-U.S. diplomacy.
There are many ambiguities, but also there are many things that, you know, we can talk about, including Iran's consistent policy of trying to keep peace. We are an anchor of stability in this region. We are a civilization. We have been here for millennia.
Participants reiterated that Iran remains committed to diplomacy, but trust has eroded.
As you saw, they were attacking all our nuclear sites, which were under IAEA constant monitoring and under the safeguard, which is the grave violation of international law. We tried also to be very measured and proportionate in our response to this aggression. Our act of defense was under Article 51 of UN Charter, but at the same time very much strategically calculated to avoid the spread of this war to the Persian Gulf and to our region.
The events also shed light on the recent geopolitical miscalculations by Israel and the United States and their failure to achieve their strategic goals.
Iran is still trying to be measured, and also trying to be very calculated. But God forbidden, if the day come and they pose any existential threat, as they sometimes you are hearing from the other side of the Atlantic, then Iran will be a different Iran. What Iran did by showing the capacity and capability of targeting, even by informing them that we are going to attack different sites, and we did it. It was a manifestation of the will and the capacity of Tehran, and this very strong message that enough is enough. Our region is very much exhausted and tired of these violations and war, and we hope that the others have got this message clearly.
According to the speakers, Iran's measured military response has shifted the narrative, forcing a reassessment in Washington. As this webinar underscores, Iran's resilience stands firm. While Israeli and U.S. objectives remain unmet, it is Tehran now that is charting its own path forward and changing the narrative. Gizum Shahmari, Tehran.
For the first time since launching its military operation in Jenin camp in late January, Israel has allowed 25 Palestinian women to briefly return to the camp. The entry was granted in coordination with the Palestinian liaison. However, three of the women were still denied access despite prior approval.
A soldier stopped us from going in, even though we had coordination. I only wanted to enter the camp, see its streets, its alleys, and my home. I wasn't going in to collect belongings. It's been 6 months since we were displaced. We haven't seen our homes. We used to stand on the edge of the mountain just to catch a glimpse. They forced us out, and we were left with nothing.
Among those who was allowed to enter the camp was Sahar Abu Zaini, who was displaced several times since 2020.
We have lived through many rounds of displacement, but this one is the most painful, both in terms of the days we are enduring and the number of martyrs and the wounded. Also, we carry the weight of what's happening in Gaza, which surpasses even our own suffering. We ask God for strength and compensation for the pain we face.
This isn't just about demolishing buildings. The Israeli regime is trying to reshape life in the camp entirely. The demolished houses represent entire lives and memories that the regime has erased.
The situation in the camp isn't like it used to be at all. All the houses are damaged, destroyed, and affected. My feeling is a mix of joy and sadness. I saw my house for the first time in 6 months. It was heavy when I returned to my house and saw it, even though it was badly affected, but we hope to return to the camp and rebuild it again.
Across the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians continue to face forced displacement and the destruction of their homes. But despite all that, they remain determined to stay on their land.
The occupying Israeli regime is changing the entire life structure of the residents of the Jenin camp by altering not only the physical space, but leaving the inhabitants, who are deeply attached to the camp, with no alternative options to make their lives sustainable. Tiba Asi, occupied Jenin.
Detonating cords, ammonium nitrate, tritium are among the materials Italy's far-right government has been illegally supplying to the Israeli regime since the start of the Gaza war in early October 2023. This is the outcome of an investigative report by the Altra Economia magazine. The report was presented on Tuesday during a public conference held at a branch premise of the Italian Senate in Rome. Despite the Italian government's denials, the magazine has exposed how the executive led by Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has been increasingly providing Tel Aviv with dual-use materials that can be easily used to build explosive or even develop thermonuclear bombs.
Italy never ever exported detonating cords nor ammonium nitrate to Israel before 2023. One could say these materials are intended for civilian purposes. However, the high quantities of exported ammonium nitrate leads us to think that it is destined for military use. As for tritium, Italy does not even produce it. Rome buys it from Germany. Rome's sale of tritium to Israel has guaranteed revenues from just a few thousand euros in October 2023 to 1.5 million euros in 2024.
During the conference, it was pointed out that these dual-use materials have been shipped to Israel through Italian companies not authorized to trade weapons. Italian magistrates have opened an investigation into a shipment of more than 13 tons of metal components destined for Israel and held at the port of Ravenna on the Adriatic coast. Since the start of the Gaza war, Italian firms have also been selling Israel light weapons, ammunition, and spare parts for M-346 trainer aircraft, acting in violation of Italy's constitution and laws.
The outcome of the magazine's report is extremely grave. Magistrates must investigate these circumstances. If our government is violating Italian norms on arms smuggling, Italy would be an accomplice in Israel's Gaza genocide.
By supporting Israel, Italy has chosen to be on the wrong side of history. Rome is completely subjugated. Disregarding international norms will lead the world to a future of wars and insecurity.
Italy is the third largest seller of arms to Israel after the United States and Germany. Over the past months, mass pro-Palestine marches have been held in Rome to denounce what the protesters see as the Italian complicity with the Israeli regime in the Gaza genocide. More and more Italians have finally realized the nefarious role played by Israel and the United States in West Asia. Max Civili, Rome.
chilling new trend is emerging in the Israeli military's genocidal campaign in Gaza. The systematic targeting of civilian cafes, lounges, and local gathering spots. Over the past few weeks, airstrikes have increasingly hit these densely populated civilian areas during peak hours, with cafes and social hubs becoming a recurring target. The Gaza Ministry of Health confirmed that dozens have been killed in at least six separate attacks on cafes and social venues in the past 10 days alone. The most prominent was when the Israeli warplanes dropped a powerful 5-ton MK-82 bomb on the Al-Baqa cafe, teeming with families, students, journalists, and artists, which resulted in at least 30 fatalities.
It was a war crime. This place was full of people fleeing the scorching heat of the tent and the lack of electricity, and came to do their work, to study, and to connect with their friends. The surrounding was also full of displaced families and tents. This was a war crime that can never be justified.
This pattern of attacks appears to be a deliberate tactic to maximize civilian casualties and the psychological devastation among the people who cling to any threat of a normal life.
Beyond the physical destruction, the deliberate targeting of cafes and lounges strikes at the heart of Gaza's social and cultural life. In a region where power outages, displacement, and trauma are the realities of every day, at Ibrahim Gaza City.
As the U.S.-Israeli attempted genocide in Gaza reaches 21 months, Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Washington amid a major protest against his arrival at the White House. It was widely reported that a ceasefire was going to be announced.
This is such a crime on such magnitude that we'll be talking for generations about this starvation and shooting. It's hard to comprehend, to be honest. It's like a nightmare that never ends. So this is the opportunity, Mr. Trump. This is your chance. Make the difference.
In what many called a twisted contradiction, no ceasefire was announced, but Netanyahu did say he had formally nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. The continued refusal of a ceasefire left many saying that Tel Aviv seeks nothing less than the complete eradication of Gaza and its people, and that only Washington could turn off the war machine.
I would like to see the U.S. first and foremost stop all arms to Israel, and they need to flood Gaza with aid. People are starving to death. People have no water. Babies have no formula. It's absolutely immoral and disgusting, and we need to get them aid as soon as possible. And it's completely possible. It's all in the hands of President Trump.
Poll after poll continues to show that support for Israel has plunged to once unthinkable levels, especially among Democrats and Americans under 50 years old.
I don't think so. Changed enough. So I don't understand how we could be still supporting Israel. Last week we sent them a little over $500 million for new weapons. I don't understand how we could be supporting Israel at all. So I wouldn't consider whatever amount of change has been to be enough. So it doesn't impress me.
As a result of their disastrous 12-day war on Iran, the two leaders are now forced to pivot from promises of regional domination and Iranian collapse to some sort of a new strategy. What appears certain to many are their likely goals: continued U.S. imperialism, an end to organized opposition toward Zionism, thwarting the democratic self-determination of the average Arab, and all at whatever the cost to Palestinian, Arab, and Iranian lives. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
Daily terror and forest displacement. This is the reality for Palestinians in the northern Jordan Valley. Following the 1967 occupation, the Israeli regime built settlements there due to its proximity with the Jordanian border, fertile land, and abundance of water availability. The first settlement, Makoza, was built in 1968, followed by the Alon Plan that led to the creation of seven new settlements. These settlements are located along the Jordanian border and on the eastern mountain slopes overlooking the Jordan Valley.
The suffering inflicted by settlers is akin to death. They forcibly displaced us, employing a brutal strategy of compelling us to obey their orders. If we refuse, they resort to stealing and killing livestock under the full protection of the army and using weapons. Furthermore, they seized land and continuously threatened the Palestinian population, creating an environment of fear and terror. In addition, they inflict physical and psychological harm by demolishing homes and depriving Palestinians of their most basic human rights.
Settler violence in the northern Jordan Valley is a daily occurrence, often with the support of Israeli soldiers. This includes the forced displacement of Palestinian farmers and herders, confiscation of their property, and physical assaults. The aim is to displace the local population and seize their land for settlements. Palestinians are denied access to their land, while settlers act with impunity, controlling resources and land as if they are the rightful owners.
The tragedy of the Jordan Valley lies in the statements of Israeli ministers and the policy of occupying regime, which is no longer hidden. We know what is happening in the Jordan Valley, and it is Israel's colonial and expansionist plan in order to expel Palestinians and replace them with settlers, demolish Palestinian homes, and tighten the noose on them, depriving them of the basics of life.
Israeli forces are systematically oppressing Palestinians, including shepherds and farmers, by confiscating essential resources like tractors and water tanks, as well as seizing their livestock. These items are being auctioned or subject to exorbitant fines, making it difficult for Palestinians to reclaim their property.
Israeli settler gangs, under the protection of the occupying forces, keep attacking Palestinians in the northern Jordan Valley on a daily basis. The regime also continues the seizure of new areas in the West Bank through its policy of forced displacement. Tiba Asi, Occupied West Bank.
The whole world is silent towards oppression. Even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Welcome back once again, dear listeners. You are listening to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. We now return to a profound and inspiring topic with A to Z of Life. Sister Zainab James introduces an Islamic Iranian lifestyle drawing from Quranic verses, prophetic traditions, uplifting poetry, moral parables, and thought-provoking stories to illuminate the path toward balance and enriched life. Then stay tuned for Spotlight, our daily roundable that highlights and examines some of the most significant and pressing events of the day. With the insight of the two expert guests, this segment offers informed commentary and analysis on current and often debated issues. We invite you to stay with us.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the middle way. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bingish Radio. Me, Sister Zainab, and so obviously the middle way is Yeah, it's another huge topic in our faith, and obviously we know that Islam is not a faith of extremes. We are all supposed to follow the middle way, the moderate path, and so neither tending to extreme on the one side nor on the other side. I'm just going to illustrate this just with a little sort of anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense by the name of Manucher Mordek. So obviously he, like all martyrs and like the, let's say, the most self-reformed, the most pious amongst us Muslims and believers, didn't like extremes in his affairs, and to such an extent even that he wouldn't talk that much. And so obviously this is a different way of looking at this sort of middle way, because typically, or very often when we were talking about the middle way and not going towards extremes, often it seems to be centered, focused on, you're not being ostentatious, not showing off our wealth, not being overly wealthy. But of course, in Islam, there's no problem with people having wealth and being wealthy. It's more about how, what we do with it, and whether we show it in an ostentatious way. So that's obvious, but obviously this idea of the moderate path has many other different sort of aspects to it. And I think maybe it's quite useful to even talk about this idea that, we don't even talk too much, because this is something that is reflected in our teachings, and the scholars tell us we're supposed to weigh our words carefully. We are not supposed to actually talk too much, because the danger is the more we talk, you know, maybe we end up talking nonsense too. That's just something that sometimes happens. And there's other elements in there which I'll explain. Welcome back to AZ here on Arabic English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that Islam has the middle way. And I mentioned this of particular attitude or behavior of the famous martyr Manucher Mordek, who wouldn't even talk too much. And maybe think about it for yourselves. What is it like? You know, obviously we all mix with families and friends or in the workplaces. And just think to yourselves, what is it like when you're with people and, you know, they just don't stop talking? And then what is it like when we're with people and we understand and we sort of can sort of tell that they're really only sort of trying to say the most important things? So there's no sort of superfluous and silly stuff in there. And they do actually pause, because, of course, the danger is if we're talking too much, if we're extreme even in our amount of conversation, how is the other person going to even be able to converse with us? I mean, how long do they have to wait? Because obviously, if we have good akhlaq, we're not supposed to sort of interrupt the other person. But if that person just talks and talks and talks, and for sure everyone knows people like that in their surroundings, family or friends or workplace, it's difficult. So this is also, in a sense, being kind, having politeness, being humble towards others, that we are aware, well, hang on, there's another person there. A conversation is a two-way process. It's not just about one person talking. And obviously, we have to think about, you know, we really want our words to have some significance, to be useful in the sense that maybe there's something informative and sort of educational in our words, maybe useful in that they, you know, they give light to the hearts of other people. That could also be very beautiful. But yeah, let's just leave it that obviously here in the podcast I have to keep talking at you. But inshallah, we can sort of be a bit more aware of that, you know, we don't just talk at or over people. Inshallah. So look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arabic English Radio, and farewell for today. thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Heavy, my hands are weak, my goals have perished, or I'm in need. My soul is empty, I need to find. How do we spend these days and lonely nights? In my sujood, I call to you to ease this hardship, this journey. Source of hope, you see my tears and how they fall. I feel the greatness of your love. Please have mercy on my soul, oh Allah. In my sujood, I call to you to ease this hardship.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
Welcome, everyone. Now, the Israeli occupation entity had enjoyed the impunity and political cover of the U.S. for over the years. It would either no longer exist, be a fraction of what it is, and generations of its leadership would have been targeted and incarcerated for egregious violations of international law, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But what we see today is a red carpet treatment of a wanted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the White House. Not only is his arrest warrant ignored, but the four judges who issued it at the International Criminal Court, they get sanctioned. And the UN rapporteur on Occupy Palestine, who's documented all the war crimes in Gaza for over 22 months, she gets sanctioned. And ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan also faced sanctions back in February. And this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, let's begin with this report.
As global institutions pursue accountability for Israeli war crimes in Gaza, the United States responds not with support for justice, but with imposing sanctions and punitive measures. Washington is shielding its ally, the Israeli regime, from scrutiny and clearly emphasizes its unwavering support in the face of international law.
As President Trump and members of Congress roll out the red carpet for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a war criminal who will be remembered as one of the monsters of modern history.
So, is justice being served or silenced? In February, the U.S. sanctioned ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan after he issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant. Their charges were war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Later on, Khan was banned from entering the U.S. and his assets were frozen. Then in June, four ICC judges were sanctioned for authorizing investigations into Israeli actions. The judges were accused of abusing power. Then the UN and ICC condemned the move as a threat to judicial independence. The latest target, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. Her July 2025 report accused Israel of committing genocide.
Following nearly 6 months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide.
The U.S. imposed sanctions on her, froze her assets, and established travel ban after she criticized European nations for granting airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu for his trip to Washington, despite his ICC active arrest warrant. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Albanese's efforts as illegitimate and shameful.
I've been smeared, attacked, I've received threats. And this has been relentless for the past 16 months. Me and my family, we have been all defamed and threatened, including my children.
International institutions are facing mounting challenges in their efforts and at serving justice and accountability. The tension between sovereign interests and established global norms prompts critical evaluation. Washington's blind support for Israel and shielding the child killer regime constitutes a blatant deviation from long-standing principles of international law.
And now for your guests. Mr. Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal, Canada. And Daniel Kovalik, human rights lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, out of the U.S. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Yves, we'll start with you out there in Montreal. Yves, giving the Israeli entity political cover, it's one thing, Yves, but this outright demonizing, targeting, and sanctioning people with a mandate to adjudicate or document crimes, you're taking on a whole different task here. Help us make a sense of what the U.S. is doing by targeting these people, including U.N. employees here.
The scope Washington's willing to go in terms of enabling the Holocaust in Gaza is absolutely remarkable. This latest move is obviously an indication of that, and the UN should be moved out of New York
mean, this is just another step down this pathway of targeting anyone, even if they are representing the whole international community, to help Israel commit more and more war crimes and slaughter against Palestinians. It's remarkable, but at this point, we have just seen one after another after another after another step down this path that Washington and its major allies have pursued in enabling Israel's crimes.
Right, and Daniel, welcome to the conversation here, and thank you for your patience. And also your initial thoughts as well, please, Daniel, on how the U.S. continues to kill the messenger here when the message and those involved in it, they encompass the most despicable crimes of wars against crimes against the humanity that this generation has witnessed.
Yeah, well, you know, a number of people pointed out the incredible irony that in the same week that the U.S. has now recognized and lifted all sanctions on the al-Qaeda leader of Syria, al-Jalani, and removed his group from the list of terrorists, has decided instead to sanction human rights activists and leaders. It really says everything about where the U.S. is today. They are the enemy of international law, the enemy of human rights. And as an American, I couldn't be more disappointed.
Thank you, Daniel. And now, Ease, this week, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, she named 48 companies that are using the Gaza genocide to fine-tune their products and make billions from the onslaught. Tech giants, weapons manufacturers, heavy equipment manufacturers, banks, even charities, there, Ease, imploring them to boycott working with Tel Aviv. She also asked European countries just the other day to not allow their airspace to be used by Benjamin Netanyahu, a wanted war criminal, to get to the States. And he gets there, ultimately, and then Donald Trump sanctions her, right, for this week's and other work that she's done in the past. I mean, in a just world, Ease, she deserves an award on her work for the Palestinian people, not the kind of scrutiny she's getting.
Yeah, well, Netanyahu suggesting Trump to get the Peace Prize for bombing Iran. Obviously, Albanese is should be in any sane world would be a thousand times more proper candidate for that. I think that that contrast is just is remarkable that they. She's demonized, even though she's the one combating genocide. I think that the probably part of this timing is that was the report was quite impactful. I know here in Quebec, it got a lot of attention. The fact that the major pension fund in Quebec is invested in genocide, and he cited that in her report. Some of the stuff on the Caisse de dépôt here in Quebec. And that got a lot of attention, and I think that was probably, quite frustrating from Israel's perspective, and from Washington's perspective. So that's maybe one of the explanations for this timing of these sanctions. But yeah, in a big picture, I mean, it's the idea that the person who is putting everything on the line. In a sense, at least in the mental health or career on the line, not like Palestinians in Gaza are putting everything on the line, but that they're targeted for doing everything they can to expose and to oppose these crimes, and then the criminal is celebrated in Washington for multiple days is quite a contrast.
And Daniel, your thoughts on the Trump administration sanctioning someone who has, to Eve's point, almost put practically everything on the line to carry out such a tedious task, Daniel, of documenting all of and opening the world's eyes to Israel's war crimes in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Now, this report we just mentioned with the 48 companies she mentioned the other week, That report was called From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. And that comes on the heels of another lengthy report. I'm just trying to outline how much time and energy she has exhausted on the Palestinian, especially this 22 months of Gaza genocide. That comes on the heels of another report called Anatomy of a Genocide, Daniel. That was from March of 2024. And another report in October of 2024 called Genocide as Colonial Erasure. Now, in the latter, Albanese identifies how Israel is expanding its genocide from Gaza to the occupied West Bank. Israel is the outlaw in this Wild West gunfight, and Albanese, she's the sheriff. What does that make, Daniel, the U.S. here?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is the enabler of this genocide. And Francesca Albanese is playing, if I may use a biblical term, really a prophetic role by calling that out. And as you say, giving everything, her sacrificing herself. By the way, I think as special rapporteur, I don't think she even gets paid. Maybe gets like a dollar or something for her work. I mean, this is basically volunteer work she's doing to advocate for the Palestinian people, to condemn a genocide, which everyone should be condemning, and then to be punished for doing that with these sanctions is outrageous. Again, it says everything about the people punishing her, right? She is the one who should get a Nobel Peace Prize. That is a no-brainer, right? And if she doesn't, it will be just an outrage, right? But we live in a time that, frankly, someone like George Orwell couldn't even satirize, right? It satirizes itself. War is peace. Again, as my colleague Eves pointed out, that you have this ridiculous show at the White House where Netanyahu shows him a letter where he's been nominated for the Peace Prize. It reminds me of when Hitler was nominated for the Peace Prize. I mean, it's that crazy. But we live in an upside-down world in which, you know, a lot of people's moral compass does not point to due north anymore.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
World Eves, the targeting of Karim Khan, also ICC chief prosecutor, and his team for issuing these arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, his ex-war minister, Yoav Gallant, for crimes against humanity, including using food and starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Eves, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the ICC team. Please tell me what their crime exactly is here. Well, how do they deserve to get sanctioned? How is their issuance of these arrest warrants not praised and applauded instead?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the criticism is that they've been way too slow and they haven't moved forward on this, of course. They Karim Khan should be criticized for being way too passive in the face of Israel's violations of international law. But the Trump administration, you know, goes after them like that. And I should say here, there's been two recent votes at the Human Rights Council, UN Human Rights Council, and the Canadian government, which claims to have been a big player in establishing the ICC and supports it, it has refused to endorse these two resolutions condemning these attacks against ICC officials. And in fact, previously, 5 years ago, I think it was in 2020, the Canadian government even sent a letter to the ICC, basically pressuring them, threatening the funding Canada's funding to the ICC if they investigated Israel's war crimes. So this is a, you know, the Trump administration has taken things to a whole new level, but this is kind of part of a broader